Good morning. Thank you for being here. Those of you who are here for session, and also for those who came to the hill today. Myself, when I woke up, I felt like I'd missed that hour from the spring forward. It's funny, these games we play, you know, with the time. What time is it? Setting the time and going by the time. The creek and the trees seem unperturbed by the hour time difference. I wanted to bring up a koan case. This is from the... I didn't get my copy of a book of equanimity back from Sumi yet, so I've got the gateless gate. That's fine. I have this old copy of a gateless gate. It was one that Robert Aiken Roshi, one of our, I'd say, close cousin in the lineage. It's one of the pioneers of American Zen, pioneer of Hawaii Zen. Of course, Aishu studied closely and knew him well. So this is his translation. And he uses, like Aishu does, he uses Chinese names. But I tend to make a poor job of that. So I think I've got the default, the Japanese, which for myself, maybe for you too, are a little easier to get the, to say, to enunciate. And then this book was, I noticed this when I picked it up again this time at Dave Scott, who I started sitting with in the UK, gave me this in the year 2000. He's one of Tenshin Roshi's successors now. Said, best wishes for year 2000 and beyond. I'm glad our life paths crossed. Good luck with your practice, whatever form it may take. Appreciate that anew in reading it, whatever form that it takes, whatever the content, I wish you well with it. This is case 23, the gateless gate. Neither good nor evil. The sixth patriarch, or sixth ancestor, let's say, was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Ta Yu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great enlightenment. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made bows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huang Mai with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huang Mai our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully. Okay, so quite a long case. The sixth patriarch, or Daikin Enno, one of the pivotal founders of the Zen tradition. So he was mentioned in the ancestral lineage which we chanted each day during session. So we have all of those names of the lineage. It traces back to the our historical founder, Shakyamuni Buddha. So we have this transmission here, the transmission of the robe and the bowl as lineage objects. Apparently that discontinued after this time. At that point it was when there was a one patriarchal teacher in that lineage, there was literally the robe and the bowl, which is said to have been the Buddha's, which was passed on down the line. Yeah. That's always kind of fascinated me. Always had, you know, a little fantasy about going on a kind of Indiana Jones hunt for the original robe and bowl. I might be sitting in a in a junk shop in Shanghai somewhere, you know. Imagine. Because it'd just be a robe and a bowl. But it is a remarkable thing that this that transmission and that lineage is continued down to the to this present day, where we can honour that and bring that to life in service in the mornings, to go through to read those names. So Daikin Enno there, the sixth patriarch in China, said he was an illiterate woodcutter. This is the, and it also represents an archetype in that way. It's always attractive to me in Zen practice, is to say anybody can do it. You know, as Master Joshu said, right, it lets horses cross, it lets asses cross the bridge, the stone bridge, lets everyone across. Poor, rich, learned, intellectual, non-intellectual. Of course, these like definitions that we pick up, they don't really fully describe, they never fully describe the unique experience that is each person. We may identify with certain aspects over others, but it's we ought to be cautious about how that identity is carried forward and lived out. Is it something that needs to be held up? Is it something that needs to be defended? You know, a lot of status that grows up like weeds around any spiritual tradition, hierarchy and status. You know? A certain amount of it is necessary. That's how it grows. Yeah, it's fertile ground. You need usually need to have someone in charge. Sounds great, sounds kind of utopian not to. But people have tried that over the years with middling results at best. You know, there's a natural hierarchy that forms. So in this case, you know, we have the sixth patriarch, who is a literate woodcutter from the south. It said when he practiced at the fifth ancestor's place, Diamond Conan, Japanese, yeah, that he wasn't admitted to the meditation hall even. He didn't have the status for that. That he worked in the rice shed, pounding rice. He prepared rice in those days, you know, even at those temples. It said that, again, the fifth ancestor, perhaps that was the first temple complex where these forms that we use now were starting to show up. And Master Dogen quotes that, there, although they had many practices, Zazen, the practice of sitting meditation, was the foundational practice. Like that is the foundational practice here. But Daikin Enno had to just work in the rice shed for a period of time. You know, somebody asked Master Rinzai, What was he doing in those years in the rice shed? Where was he? Where was he? You know, so a deeper question. And Master Rinzai said, drowned in a deep spring. Drowned in preparing rice. Drowned in prepping lunch. Drowned in cleaning the bathroom. Absorbed in the activity of this present experience. Not looking for something else. Not looking for a happier or a better place, such as our predilection. Do we really inhabit this experience? Is it home? Or is there a gap there? You know, session is that is really rubbing our noses in that reality. Have these many pointers and different voices that can raise things up. But it always comes back to this one who sees through these eyes, as Roshi says, this one, now. And that question, are you satisfied? Are you at home? His reputation, of course, must have grown, Daiken Enno. You see when somebody has insight, you know, and it doesn't have to just be at a temple. Recently, I was at the Starbucks in Koreatown, this thing where, by ZCLA, where Yushin has an apartment. And I talked to a homeless lady who came in, you know, like kind of pushing a walker and asking for change. We had an interaction, and I just watched as she had kind of other interactions in the Starbucks and made her, then she left. And I was just kind of just watching, and she walked past. I didn't think she was concerned with me at all. And then as she just walked past, she just stopped and looked at me and smiled with great sincerity, genuineness. You know, teachings show up in all kinds of places, not just at a temple. Of course, if we really penetrate into what a temple is, then you never leave the temple. You never leave the sacred ground. There is nothing but sacred ground, wherever that is. You know, here the conditions are brought together so that it is most obvious, most apparent. Things are set up in that way. And this is why Daiken Enno went to this temple. So with a certain insight, but then he begins to practice amidst a community. And there's the, you may know this if you know some Zen lore. When I came into this practice, I was a voracious reader for the lineage and the lore and things around that, you know, the Zen stories, and read, study all of that. So there was a poetry competition. It said that the fifth patriarch wanted to retire. I don't know how old he was. Zen masters typically have a difficult job retiring. And he decided to set up a poetry contest. You know, we have that beautiful thread coming down to us from China, a poetic expression. And again, Master Dogen had said that poetry was the closest expression of words to the Dharma. And the fifth patriarch asked the community, write a poem, whoever writes the best poem becomes my successor. Maybe we could try that here. Then the head monk wrote this poem. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. Moment by moment, wipe the mirror carefully. Let there be no dust upon it. The body is the Bodhi tree. This body, our body, this body of reality, is the Bodhi tree. It's the tree that Shakyamuni sat under when he saw the morning star. This body that's coming home when you don't look for the Bodhi tree or the seat of enlightenment. You realize that it is this seat and this body. And it's not enough to realize that. It can be realized somewhat intellectually, but that's a deeper coming home, to go beyond that and to know it, to really know it in your bones, in the heart, this body that includes everyone else, no matter what lines we draw between each other, you know, the way that we separate over and over, blame, pick and choose. With realization, then we come to see that that is just picking and choosing and separating. Yet there is this one body, the Bodhi tree, the mind like a clear mirror. After a 7-day session, you may have a mind like a clear mirror. You know, you should be cautious too. After, you know, cultivation of focus or samadhi, we might say, you know, often we're cautioned, don't blow that steam off. You know, sometimes after session, it's like move into party mode from getting through it. We have to be careful though, because, you know, the clear mirror gets clouded up pretty quickly, or can be. The mind is like a clear mirror. Is that so? This is what the head monk says. Moment by moment, wipe the mirror carefully, let there be no dust upon it. Wipe it carefully, let there be no dust. You know, there's some action in there and some doing. After when we learn a meditation practice, there's some method there. There's some doing. We bring a little something in for the greater good. You know, perhaps we need to wipe the mirror with 1,000 breaths counted, 10,000 breaths. You know, often, the practice of sitting, many of us, the mirror is pretty clouded. You know, this life that we have, our conditioning, our patterns, the story puts a lot of stickers up on the mirror. Things that we see when you look, you see the stickers, the descriptions, the names, the positions, you don't see right through. So perhaps, you know, sometimes there is that wiping to remove the dust. Practice of meditation. So, you know, it can be popular to look at the first poem, if you know anything about this story, before the sixth patriarch puts his up, and to disapprove of it. He might disapprove of the first poem. But what he says is not incorrect. What he says is his expression. Always this asks us, what is my expression? What would I say? How would I sum it up? It's good to put oneself to the test. You know, easy as a human being. But we look out, we hear words. They don't have to be Zen words, it could be anything. Easy to always find the fault in another. And to find a fault in what we read or hear about. You know, or we could feel righteously indignant about somebody doing something wrong or saying something wrong. But often that's not really a place that brings much benefit. Always the responsibility is turned back on. Each of us. What do you say? What do I say? How do I see it? The sixth patriarch had somebody read the poem to him. Being illiterate. And then wrote his own. Had somebody write it up there. Fortunately, they didn't prank him. You know, what the other guy had written. And he says, Bodhi really has no tree. The mirror, too, has no stand. From the beginning, there's nothing at all. Where can any dust alight? So using the words of the original poem, he points at something. What is it that he points at?
Emptiness.
Emptiness. What does emptiness look like?
Well, you can't dust it.
Hmm?
You can't dust it.
Bodhi has no tree. The mirror. What mirror? Has no stand. This doesn't rely on anything. Isn't conjured up. Created from what? What can you say? When you look at our life directly, how can it be explained? What does this life rely upon? Yeah. It's good not to go straight over the top and take this as like, oh, that's a bit better, that one. That poem, he says, know this and know that, like a hard sutra. You know, this is a challenge to see this. From the beginning, there's nothing at all. You know, when we, all these Zazen periods that we sit, or have done this week, or now at the beginning, you know, as we go into a training period, what is it for? You know, as we take the posture, embrace the forms that we have now, always the opportunity to really go beyond construction. A construction that always wants to understand, to know, to feel safe, to work it out, to feel powerful, to feel all of these things. Or can we, this is the challenge, can our Zazen be beyond or before that construction? To sit in accord with our life, this experience, as it is, with all positioning, all judgment, all value system, all prejudice extinguished, so that not a hair or a particle of dust is raised. And you rely on nothing. Nothing is needed. Nothing extra. Nothing needs to be let go of, other than, you know, this impulse to always wash the content through our accumulated, conditioned pattern. The mirror has no stand, and yet this life relies on nothing. And yet you look around, and yet this appears. How incredible that is. How incredible this is, I should say. Is it not profound and mysterious that we appear, that this is this? You know, we can say just this, or always point back to this, and it's just like this. Look at this, at who and what we are. As you cease to rely on the definition or the understanding, a deeper understanding comes forward, the deeper understanding that you are the essence, which is mysterious and profound. From the beginning, there is nothing at all. There is nowhere for any dust to alight. It can never be stained or disturbed. Worlds crash into one another. You know, black holes and spinning galaxies and the minutiae of human relationships, things growing and decaying, coming and going. And yet, there's this. The fifth patriarch sees this poem, calls the sixth, the soon-to-be sixth ancestor into his room, midnight. He gives him the robe and the bowl. Reminds me of when, in the koan where Hyakujo is the Tenzo, wins a similar competition, becomes an abbot, and in the verse Mumon said he traded an apron for a iron yoke. Becoming the abbot. A ladle, rather. Swapped his ladle for an iron yoke. Becomes the next ancestor. Passes it on to Daiken Enno after this poem. There's a lot of nice visual metaphor here, as it said, that he rows him across to the other shore, across the lake. You can imagine it at midnight, perhaps as a full moon like those last night. You know, the sound of water, a mountain environment, not unlike this one. He rows him across. And he has to take off. He has to get out of there. So much status and hierarchy at the temple. The fact that transmission's been given to this loser from the south is scandalous. He has to run for his life. Head up to the mountains. And he is pursued by the monk, Ming, another monk. Not the head monk who wrote the poem, but somebody, a leader in the community, said that he'd formerly been a general. So somebody pretty robust, doesn't give up easily. You know, he pursues him. Pursued by the monk Ming to the peak. Seeing him coming, I can't shake this guy. He puts the robe and the bowl down, the transmission down, and says, There should be no fighting over it. Take it with you. Take it with you. If it's not earned, it's of no value. Yeah. He realizes then, Ming, that as he tries to lift it up, it's as immovable as a mountain. You could take that like something, some, you know, cosmic thing happened. But he realizes at that moment, this is worthless if I do this now. The robe, take the robe and the bowl. What does it mean? You know, and it's important to see the condition here. I talked in the last talk about with this koan to put yourself in the position. You know, this guy's just run up a mountain, angry, frustrated, righteously indignant. And he runs. He finally catches his prize. And when it comes to the moment where he can turn in one way or another, he's wide open, shivering and trembling. He said, I came for the Dharma. I came for the teaching, not the robe, not the trappings of the rakasus, of the koromos, or the incense, or the bells. I came for the truth. I came for the Dharma. I beg you, please open the way for me. You know, it's like echoes a few generations back. Taiso with Eka, Bodhidharma, outside Bodhidharma's cave. Please put the mind to rest for me. I came for a teaching. Please give me something. Open the way for me. The sixth patriarch replies, answers, don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of the head monk? What is the original face? An excellent question. And you know, you can skip over the perhaps we're tempted, okay, don't think good, don't think evil, that's good. Let me get to the meat of it. Oh, original face, that sounds like it might have been. No, very important not to skip that over. Don't think good. Don't think evil. Don't fall into dualism. In the Jukai ceremony, it has that line where it says, where you vow to no longer follow people of dualistic understanding. I like that. You no longer can drink the Kool-Aid of right and wrong. You see that there is something that includes right and wrong. The right and wrong is never complete. It's always a shade. It's always a perspective. It's always open to interpretation. What is the deeper truth? What is it that goes beyond right or wrong? If you are thinking good and thinking bad, then you're a person of good and bad. Always subject to opinion, position, a notion. You know, so he says right there, like, throw that out. Don't take any position. Don't think good. Don't think bad. At this very moment, you know, so cutting off the escape routes, at this very moment, what is the original face? What is your original face? Keizan joking down in the lineage again, in the lineage who chanted in the mornings, a couple of generations down from Dogen, gave suggestion for Zazen. I remember reading this, and I hadn't read it before, and I thought, oh, this, you know, Keizan joking, talking about Zazen, what's this? And he says, take the posture, breathe in, exhale, aim the gaze down the bridge of the nose, and look at the original face. That's it. That's enough. That is all that is required for Zazen. Set aside good, set aside bad. Set aside the notions. Cut off all escape routes of going somewhere else. And look. experience this original nature thoroughly, absorbed, like the sixth patriarch in the rice shed, in pounding rice. You do it in Zazen, in just sitting. That is then experienced and taken. You can take that forward. It's experienced in walking, talking. You know, we're so easily often confused by the world of things and the content that we get overwhelmed. The mirror starts to cloud up. We become identified with the forms and the rising and falling and this problem and that problem. So we come back. This is why it's a practice to come back to the place that is before, the place before good and evil came into the world. This original nature. You know, skipping ahead to the verse, when he said this to the head monk, Wumen or Mumon, said, the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He's like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed and puts it into your mouth. All you have to do is swallow it down. You peeled it, you got it ready. Don't do this, don't do that, don't go anywhere else, and put him on the spot. Perhaps a ripe condition for realization. But if we imagine that the condition for realization is not ripe, now, in this condition, then we are always chasing. Always chasing and looking for it. Running up and down mountains, looking for something called enlightenment. But the peeled lychee just needs to be swallowed. Now. And it said that Ming had great realization, bathed in sweat. Well, he's probably bathed in sweat anyway, he just ran up a mountain. But sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made bows, saying, beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance? This guy's greedy. You know? Not content with great realization, what else we got? It's interesting. See how he became a general, you know? What's the next rank? Sixth patriarch said, what I have conveyed to you is not secret. What is it that is transmitted? You know? What is the robe and the bowl? It's not a secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you. Ming said, though I practiced at the fifth ancestor's place with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. And there's caution there too, you know. You can attend a Zen center, you can live a one, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years. There's no guarantee, you know, perhaps by a process of attrition, you know, but perhaps not. You know, unlike golf, you can play this game forever and not get any better at it. It really has to be done. You can't rely on something to come. I could not realize my original face. But thanks to your pointed instruction, I'm like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is warm or cold. It's a beautiful expression. Famous Zen expression, you know. The realization. Somebody can talk to you about water, describe it, show pictures of it, explain it in a thousand ways, it doesn't quench thirst. When you drink for yourself, you can say whether it's warm or cold. Or you can say nothing at all, or as much as you like. It's yours. Lay brother, you are now my teacher. And very shrewdly, the sixth patriarch says, if you can say that, let us both call the fifth ancestor our teacher. You know, I don't need a traveling companion. I'm going this way. We'll both call him our teacher, but you go that way. I'm going to keep going. It's said that he stayed out for 10 years in the mountains, living with hunters and lived in anonymity, which is a tradition that's still maintained in some schools, through the Rinzai tradition. You know, to finish training and then go out into a world and live anonymously. You know, to snuff out all identification with status, any idea of Zen. You know, I have a friend who trains in Japan, and he said there was somebody there who'd kind of been there many years, finished koan study, and when he left, he went to work at Burger King. He wanted to work at Burger King in Kyoto.
What better place?
That'll test your realization. That'll test your Zen. Right? You go into the world and you see people and the way, you know, people working, living, raising families, you know, all kinds of like difficult situations. It's so extraordinary.
It's like that 10 oxygen picture. Somebody goes out, he just goes back into the marketplace.
And then the last line here, maintain your realization carefully. That's interesting. If you really see it, is there something there that needs to be maintained? What is it that's maintained? Always there's refinement. Always there's the re-entering in. Like that saying, don't turn your back on the ocean. You know, careful not to carry something, to put a sticker back on the mirror, only this time the sticker of attainment or realization, but a true return to the ordinary. To the person of no rank. This transition, again from session now into training period. Maintain it carefully. I say that to myself. I'd like to open it up if anyone has any questions or comments. Oh, good. Yeah.
And she says for her path is seeing everything in good and evil, black and white. And she always chooses good. She always goes in that direction. in others and in her decisions and even just appreciating the sun coming up. Mm-hmm. It's just being around her, I see all the different ways she chooses good. And that seems to really work for her and be a fine for her.
Yeah.
She's, you know, enjoyable to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And has a lot to teach and a lot to give. For some, good enables a path and seeing in dualistic manner. It seems to be a way.
And yeah.
Like there's yeah. a way for everyone.
You know, for myself, it's like with moving to a Zen temple or being at a training temple, it's like I always remind myself to be conscious of time and not to coast or be careful what it is that I'm actually doing. Otherwise, it is a chronic waste of time. It's terrible, you know. There are plenty of so-called dualistic, people of dualistic understanding who are doing a very nice job for people at the food bank or wherever else. But everyone finds that you find your own way. You know, maybe for this person, this what is good or what is bad is the choice of looking at things with a direct eye, with the eye of truth, and the knowing of what the appropriate thing is, the appropriate response. The language may be different. Thank you. Yeah.
You know, we talk in what we read in service, it says the absolute and relative,
yeah.
like two arrows meeting in midair. I mean, we live in the relative world, right? The world of good, bad, up, down, black, white. Isn't that what the relative is?
Isn't that what
the relative is that talks about in the, I don't know what it's
mm-hmm.
called. The absolute is like the emptiness and the vastness, and the relative is this three-dimensional world, isn't it?
Well, it's a temporary scheme. So we raise up something called the absolute, because that's not seen. You know, we're good at the world, we're good at the relative, we're good at the discrimination. So some that is raised up in order for you to look until you understand what this absolute or intrinsic nature is. But while it's different, while it's still separate from the world of form, of a world of discrimination, that's not yet it.
Well, it's not it. But I've been thinking about this a lot during Sesshin. I mean, isn't there a lot to be said about seriously looking at the relative, the good, the bad?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that in the relative world, we are separate. We all have our personalities. We are completely, completely separate from each other, from the trees, from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of to revel in that, it's quite wonderful. And then the absolute, when we can realize the absolute, it helps us to, we don't have to figure out how to live in the relative. It kind of lives for, well, I'm not saying, I don't even want to say that, but we talk so much about the absolute, and I've really been thinking a lot about the relative, choosing good over bad,
mm-hmm.
and making the conscious choice, not just going to the absolute and saying whatever is, is. But to kind of live in the relative world and say, I choose good over evil.
Mm-hmm.
I choose kindness over cruelty. I'm not saying that very well. But
No, that's fine. You know, the Buddha, in his teaching, or one of his teachings, said, first, see the emptiness. Then, study cause and effect. So
it almost seems like the other way around, because you are in cause and effect. I'm not trying to be contradictory.
No,
I'm just kind of.
They
you
said
know, it seems
the Buddha
like
had it backwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you use your inquiry to look at this from whatever angle you look at it from, you know, but just don't be blocked by these words, absolute and relative. You know, if we believe in something called the absolute, big problem. If we believe in something called the relative, big problem. It's not two worlds, it's not two lives. But also to be careful. If you say, you know, as it says further in that sutra, to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. You know, we may glimpse or see to some degree, okay, now I understand somewhat what they're talking about with the absolute. If that occurs, throw that out, because that is not the absolute.
What about if you understand something relative? Do you throw that out too? I mean, I kind of really want to know, because mm-hmm. the relative is an arrow just like the absolute, right? I don't know. I've been really confused about this.
Yeah. We'll continue to look.
Okay.
You know, in that line it says they strike each other in midair.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the point to look at. That's the edge. That's the point of practice that it needs. And thank you. It's a good question.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I have been thinking about fluidity a lot.
About what, sorry?
Fluidity.
Yeah.
Because basically I was also very much like black and white thinking. And now I'm forced to actually work with people who committed something a little bit bad, you know, let's say domestic violence. And I have to see their point of view. And if this was not about my work, I wouldn't like them.
Yeah.
Now I'm kind of trying to like them because I have to interact with them and listen to them and communicate. And I can see how I'm in a little bit pushing myself to be fluid, trying to step by step, and it works. I still cannot do it, but I think I like it very much, this fluidity of seeing things, integrating in a way, the opposite somehow.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
And it is, I think it's a very gentle awareness somehow. But this thing about being fluid is fascinating for me.
Mm.
It's going against my own upbringing.
Yeah, it keeps things interesting too, right? And I appreciate that you're always learning. You know, we're always learning in that way. Being open to new direction, new perspective, always going beyond.
It keeps me, like, my mind active, you know.
Yeah.
As if there is nothing, like, and oh, this is how it is. And I just put it in a category. It seems that the boundaries are kind of fluid and there is always something is changing.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, last one.
Yeah, I think it's hard for us as human beings to be in that place of fluidity because it's not so safe. If we say this is this and that is that, then it compartmentalizes things. And then we feel safe because we can define it. And I think the teachings are really about not resting in that place that allows us to be safe, that allows us to be actually open to what happens when we don't hold on to the things that give us this sense of safety.
Mm.
And we let things be as they are. So you sit in Zazen, I sit in Zazen, my knees hurt like crazy. But at the same time, something else is happening that settles me so much deeper into the place of being that I coexist with that pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that is amazing teaching, because that's what happens in life. The woman whose back doesn't work, she is trying to coexist with whatever that is by looking at the sun shining and the sky being blue, because that helps mitigate the pain. Anyway, I've been really concerned about this sense of safety, because when I come here to do what I'm doing, it's out of my safety comfort place. I'm
yeah, no kidding.
Just slightly. Part of me is totally freaking out, and another part of me is going, okay, you're here.
Yeah.
Settle.
Carry on.
So, we as human beings don't want to be in a place where we can settle with the things that make us uncomfortable.
Mm.
So if we can define them and make this right and that wrong, it helps us feel safer. But maybe nothing's right and nothing's wrong. It just is. And I think about my dogs. They're just here. You know, they're not thinking, well, it's hard. No, it's not hard. I'm not getting them food. They're just like,
maybe.
Here.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Could be thinking all kinds of things. It could be plotting a coup right now.
Well, I wanted to say something too, like about what Tima and Sumi were saying, and Denise, is I have a violent criminal in my family, my brother, and when I see things in good and evil and black and white, I can't go to meet him where he's at. But if I see it more as a spectrum and go to that place, I can find a way to meet him, or I have in the past, when I don't see through that lens of black and white and good and evil. I can more reach all people, including my brother and those that are maybe in the hell realms.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just wanted to put that out there, too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think there's a good reason we're uncomfortable with setting aside good and evil, because there's a great danger there.
Mm-hmm.
We have to operate in the world. We have to make choices. But we don't have to make that define our mind. It doesn't have to make our mind rigid.
Mm-hmm.
So then again, relative and absolute. Relatively speaking, we have to make choices, and hopefully ones that are more beneficial than not. But if that's locked in here, then we're locked in.
That's opened a can of worms, this koan, didn't it? We'll do moo next time. Thank you. We'll finish.